This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Many young kids grow up spending time after school with other kids in their neighborhood, playing pickup soccer, video games, or capture the flag. But Amanda Holliday grew up on a street where there weren't many children, so she spent her time with elderly neighbors. She'd visit Miss Turner for peanut butter cookies or go to Clyde Smith's house to help him work on his cars. And from a young age, she felt comfortable around older adults and loved to listen to their stories. When she was in high school, she spent more than 1,500 hours volunteering in nursing homes and began to notice that others in her community paid little attention to the elderly, especially when it came to food. Since then, she has devoted her life's work to thinking about older adult nutrition and how food can be an important tool in making sure older adults are integrated into our society. She advises long-term care facilities and hospitals around the state on elder nutrition and is also the program director for the UNC Chapel Hill Master's Program in Public Health Nutrition. Amanda Holliday joins us in the studio today. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
You grew up as an only child in Raleigh.
Yes.
Tell us about this neighborhood you lived in and your neighbors.
Well, I grew up on a dead-end street in Raleigh, not far from J.C. Park. And as you described, I grew up on a street where there were mostly older adults. And at that time, you know, I have some of the best parents that exist. And they would let me walk around the neighborhood and visit. And I always felt accepted. As you know, Mr. and Mrs. Turner across the street, I could go in and we'd make peanut butter cookies and we'd take our forks and press out the shapes on the top. And Sam and Jean Wilkinson and go over there and feed the squirrels. And, you know, Mrs. Gillum and Mr. and Ms. Jackman, Mr. Lindsay, I have memories of all of them doing different things. And I always felt accepted and welcomed and was just at home.
And it is kind of true. Certainly it is the image, the first image that comes to mind. If a child comes to the door of an older adult, there'll be some conversation, but there's going to be food and it's going to be good, right?
Absolutely. And when you're a child, they certainly offer you a lot of sweets, too. So that doesn't hurt.
Stories go down better. And then you spent summers with your grandparents, right? Tell us what that was like.
Right. So I spent a lot of time in the summers and during the year with my grandparents. It's being from North Carolina and having one set of grandparents in the Piedmont part of the state in Davidson County in Denton, North Carolina. And then the other set on the eastern part of the state, Pasquotank County in Elizabeth City. My father's father died when I was young, so I don't have tons of memories of him, of course, but remember my grandma. And so they were very different people. Both grandmas were a huge influence in who I am and what I do today.
Did they all like to cook? Because it's kind of, I will just tell you briefly about my grandparents. My grandmother, my father's mother, loved to cook. She was this amazing Italian, you know, second generation Italian, lots and lots. My mother's mother, on the other hand, my mother likes to joke that when I heard that it was just like home cooking, I used to run the other way. She wasn't so good. So were they both pretty good at around the kitchen?
I thought they were both good. You know, they had very different styles. My grandma in Denton, North Carolina, let me participate. You know, we would make biscuits. She made biscuits every day. And it was okay to stand on the stool and put flour everywhere. Now that I'm a parent of a younger child, I think, wow, she had to pay really a lot of patience. But we picked, you know, I picked blackberries and they had strawberries and I caught frogs and we just enjoyed food as it was grown, and I got to participate in making pies and whatever it was.
One of your grandmothers was an extension agent, right?
Correct. The other grandma, Grandma C in the eastern part of the state, was an early home economist extension agent and would go and educate families, particularly women's groups, on healthy eating, particularly safe food handling practices. So canning and how to safely can, for example, and as food came in, how to prepare it, how to store it, and serve your family a healthy diet.
That might mean that one of your grandmas used hands full of flour while the other had a measuring cup. I don't know.
That could be. Yes, yeah. That would probably be true.
And you spent a lot of time then volunteering in nursing homes. Was that in high school?
That was. So That actually got my interest got piqued in that from my grandma in Denton. We would go to visit my great grandma, and I have a very early memory of singing in nursing homes and participating and helping. And as a child, it never seemed scary or off limits. I mean, we went to be with friends. And then as I got older and had my choice in what I could do in my free time, I volunteered in nursing homes and have really fond memories of having freedom to just help out where help was needed.
Well, that is unusual because you think especially high school kids, middle school and high school, just don't want to be around older adults. This is even true for adults. They don't want to be around older adults. It's ironic in a way that some of the ways in which they might handle their food is the way little kids do. But we seem to be more tolerant when it comes to children than we are for older adults.
Yes, and what we serve, I find that we spend a lot of time trying to serve small children colorful foods and foods that taste good and are at the peak of season. And I, particularly in high school, saw that that wasn't the case. I was not impressed with what was being served and didn't want to eat it myself. And I felt really upset about that. I mean, these are people that got our society to where we are and served our country. And how could we be serving them what I thought looked like overcooked mess?
It's interesting because, again, if you think about the fact that a lot of folks don't like to be around old people, particularly when they're eating, they will conflate the messy glop that's being fed to them, particularly in those industrial kind of conditions, with the adult themselves. So there's this gray bilious mass that might be dripping out of off the fork, and it all becomes one scene that they would not like to repeat. You were able to separate those two and say, this is an adult human being who's being fed this thing, which is the thing that's actually making me sick.
Yeah, I have a really clear memory of volunteering in high school of a man sitting in a wheelchair with dementia and not able to feed himself, and looking at that sort of gray slop, as you describe it, he was having trouble with swallowing, so he had to be on a pureed diet, and just being hungry but not being able to eat, and then seeing that and turning his head away and not wanting to eat, and I thought, this is wrong. This shouldn't be this way. I got to do something about this.
Talking with an expert in adult nutrition, especially senior adult nutrition, Amanda Holliday, today on The State of Things. Getting a sense of what led her to become a nutritionist who specializes in senior nutrition. Is that when you decided to make this a career?
Well, it certainly had a huge influence. I think I got initially interested in nutrition because I had high cholesterol as a child, and I saw a dietitian. And you have certain experiences that really stick with you. And I had a very nice, wonderful dietitian who I thought a lot of. And so I had on one hand, I was very interested in nutrition, and I saw that I was able to be healthier by making better choices. And then I also, at the same time, I just love being with people who are older than me. And so, at that time, those things started coming together for me, and I always felt drawn to feed people, to sit next to someone and help them eat. It just seems at the core of who we all are.
That may be how you sort of made a distinction. You talked about the man who turned his head away from that nasty stuff on his plate. Apparently, everybody at the home was saying, oh, yeah, he's lost his appetite. You went back to them and said, you know, I think I know why.
Yeah, he needs something that tastes better and would look like it would be real food. Exactly. And I really want to see when we have people of all ages in that situation that we don't just default to pureeing whatever it is we're feeding someone else, that we get creative. And if you aren't going to eat it, then why would you feed it to someone?
Did anything change for that man?
Yeah, I remember stopping off at they had a little canteen or place, and using money to buy foods, particularly bananas and peanut butter, mashing that up and trying to feed him, which tasted really good. I mean, it's like peanut butter and banana sandwich, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I remember him eating that, and that was just was fun for me because I was so happy. Well, he was eating.
Did you feed that information back to the cafeteria folks? I mean, did it change his diet going forward?
Yeah, you know, I don't actually remember the dietitian there very well, but I remember talking to the nurse about it and saying, you know, it might just be this banana smells so much better. We gave people real food that would smell and taste better. That would make a difference.
I guess the other thing is people are a little bit self-conscious about feeding older adults too. I mean, first of all, the idea of just leaving the tray and walking out of the room seems like it might be difficult to eat. The idea of not eating in some community. But then how do I do the feeding and do that with the kind of dignity and respect their dignity?
Mm-hmm. Well, particularly with dementia, you know, people can eating can change quite drastically when you're dealing with dementia. And you're right. We those of us who are helping that person, trump to the feeding practices of when we fed our children. So we use sort of this, here comes the airplane. And that's very disrespectful. And there are other strategies that we can use. For example, sitting off to the side and putting their hand in ours and holding the fork and then guiding them. And you know, using that as a time to maybe put our arm around that person and share old memories and talk about the food.
Amanda Holliday is my guest this hour. She's program director for the UNC Chapel Hill Master's Program in Public Health Nutrition. We will continue our conversation about her life and career on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking with Amanda Holliday, program director for the UNC Chapel Hill Master's Program in Public Health Nutrition. She's devoted her career to thinking about older adult nutrition and how we use food to make sure that older adults are integrated into our society. And we were talking before the break about growing up in Raleigh and spending time in nursing homes. Then you went away to college. And you brought some important relics of your childhood with you. Tell us about those.
I did. You know, it's before I left for college, I took pictures of every single person on my street, and I made a collage of them standing in front of their home. And I'll never forget moving in at Appalachian and being in my bunk bed and putting on the wall on the lower level this picture of all of those special people from my childhood. I still have that collage, and I still think of them fondly.
So, but your roommates, what'd they think?
Didn't say much. Gave me that look of, what in the world? Who are those people?
Did you? It somehow gave you comfort just to have them. And by then you had decided that nutrition was going to be where you were headed, right?
I did. I was very fortunate to know early what my major was going to be. And I knew from the get-go that I was going to major in nutrition. At that point, I didn't know necessarily what that meant for a career. I knew registered dietitian was the way I wanted to go. But I knew I was going to major in nutrition.
But then the connection with older adults hadn't quite been made yet.
Right. I met with my advisor, and I had actually pulled out the catalog when we had paper catalogs, and I was reading all the classes. You know, you go to college and you have all these classes that you're just every one you're interested in. And I found myself in the sociology section, and I looked in the sociology department, and they had this whole two pages on the study of gerontology in these classes. And I felt so drawn to them. I wanted to take them. And so I went to my advisor and said, I want to take these classes. And I remember her looking at me like, but you're majoring in nutrition. And I said, well, do people ever get a minor in gerontology? And she was like, well, go talk to them. And so sure enough, I took overloaded and took extra classes and was able to still get out on time, but minored in gerontology. And I still draw from my knowledge in those classes when I teach my classes today.
How are there classes now in senior adult nutrition? I mean, it sounds like that was a field that hadn't been plowed yet.
No, definitely not. And I remember them thinking I was odd to show up, you know, well, tell us why you're here. And they were glad to have me, but I remember them wanting to know more. Now, yes, most nutrition programs will have a nutrition and aging course.
Early in your career, then, you got involved in a congregant meal program, or several of them. Tell us about those.
So I first started participating in the congregant meal program, which is, of course, got started through the Older Americans Act, and it is an opportunity for older adults to gather together and eat, and that takes many forms throughout the U.S. I started volunteering in the Congregate Meal Program in Boone. It was a short walk from campus, and it immediately felt at home. I was in a rec center where probably 50 older adults came to eat, and I remember helping get the food set up and helping prepare and plan the menus and then eating with everyone, and it just felt peaceful.
How does it work? Where does the food come from? Who does the cooking?
It all depends on the county and the place. Some will contract with local restaurants or sometimes catering companies, farmers. It just depends on where you are. And then they have employee and volunteers who will prepare the food. The menus are overseen and approved by a registered dietitian. And then any senior over the age of 60 and their caregiver can come and eat. And it's fabulous. I mean, I wish more people would participate. A donation is asked for, but not required.
It is surprising, I guess, how little we think about the social quality of eating. I mean, you know, we hear over and over complaints that people don't sit around the table together at dinner. But I mean, it's vital for holding any kind of social unit together of any size, isn't it?
Absolutely. And family meals are one of the most important, I think, family activities that we have and that we should not let that go. And also sitting down at the table with family members of all ages and learning and listening and being together. Food is the starting point for that, but the togetherness that we have and the opportunity to teach and learn from each other is magnificent.
Well, and it feels so natural and so inborn. I mean, I've got a 3-year-old grandson who will not have a sip of juice unless you have a glass of juice with him. You must sit down, whatever it is, a cookie, you know, then Papa, you can have a cookie too. You have to have it with him. He will not eat unless someone's eating with him.
Yeah.
He gets it right away, right?
And you think about older adults who are eating alone. They don't eat as high-quality diet and are less likely to eat enough food. And so the nice thing about the Congregate Meal Program is that it is a place. It's really more than just a meal. You're together. A lot of times there are activities and other things that go on that start out of that. And friendships are made. And so I really enjoyed my time in Boone volunteering. And I would find myself going there sometimes 4 and 5 days a week just to be with the friends that I'd made.
Then you became interested in helping with dementia care units, which is just not quite the same as elderly care, right? And why did you become interested and what did you learn there?
Well, I first got interested in dementia care when I was in Chicago. I left Appalachian with a degree in nutrition and a minor in gerontology, and I went to Chicago, went to Rush to do my graduate work. And I was fortunate to be in a fabulous nutrition program, but also got the opportunity to study under an excellent geriatrician. And he took me under his wing, and he had a pretty busy dementia unit. And I remember him saying, we don't know how to get these people fed. I mean, it's just really hard for us to keep weight on them. I mean, why don't you do some work into that? That would really be helpful. And that's how it got started. A lot of my colleagues were scared, and I never understood why. I wasn't ever scared. I felt like these were just like the people on my street. They just were dealing with something a little bit different.
Well, but it is a little different. And again, if you think about the sociology of community, I mean, you've heard 1,000 people say this, whether they're old or not. You know, when I'm alone cooking for one, I don't feel like cooking. I don't feel like eating. I mean, obviously, having people around you is a reason to eat.
Absolutely.
I want to be alive because there's another person who cares that I live.
Yeah.
I mean, that shouldn't be too hard to figure out. But when you have dementia, the equations aren't really, not working as well. And the connection between that friendship and that food doesn't seem as apparent. So what do you do? How do things change?
Well, I think you keep that at your core, what you mentioned, those connections. We try to be creative. You know, dementia manifests its way differently in everyone. We know that those long-term memories are still there. So trying to capitalize on them, engaging people with dementia in meal preparation, you know, we sort of take that away from them. But those as we talked about, you know, those motions and those smells stay with us. So I would say, you know, some things to think about are incorporating them. It might not be over a hot stove, but it might be peeling potatoes or mixing up batter or making eggs, for example. But then also get creative. Break out of the mold that dinner has to be this way. Many people with dementia will wander or will need to be moving. And, you know, capitalize on that. What are some foods that you can put in their hands so that they can eat while they're moving? And smell. We all have memories of smell. And, you know, every time I smell cookies baking, my stomach grumbles. And the same thing goes when you're at any age and if you have dementia. So trying to think creatively, you know, getting candles that have food smells or having food cooking before you serve someone really heightens your appetite. And then one of the things that I really love is serving foods in traditional packaging. So, for example, not that I'm hugely endorsing lots of Coca-Cola, but, you know, serving Coca-Cola in its glass bottle and asking the person, when did you ever have one of these when you were young? And tell me about it. You know, reaching back into those memories. Well, did you make stuffing when you were younger? And tell me how you made your stuffing at Thanksgiving. Those remembrances and being together really will, you'll find that a lot of times people will eat more. And as you mentioned, there's togetherness and connection.
Some sense of self returns, and that self then can connect. It's fascinating. Muscle memory, olfactory memories, all of that. Creative stuff. Wonderful. And you've had, I assume, success in all of this.
Yes. I do a lot of work in helping families and groups that are dealing with this. And we try to start from the person in the chair and how they're sitting to the plate and the color of the plate and what the food looks like, eating with our eyes and our noses, right? And the sound in the room, the lighting in the room, who's with you, where's that person sitting, what's on the table. I see so many dementia facilities take all the things off the table, no flowers. It's just like you get your meal, but why not put a basket of apples on the table? Or, you know, you don't have to give all that up. And that's truly one of the biggest joys in life is working with folks in problem solving and helping, trying to improve someone's nutrition status.
You clearly derive a great deal of joy in being with older people. And I would guess then have experienced death a little more often than those of us who don't spend that much time. I mean, is that difficult for you?
Well, I'm a spiritual person, so, you know, I believe that although we will miss them here, they're going on to a very happy place. I never really thought about that much till I was older. I mean, I remember people dying on our street and people dying that I had become friends with in the nursing homes, but I there was, of course, sadness, but I never dwelled on that. You know, I felt privileged to have the opportunity to know them. Doesn't mean I don't miss them, but I think it also is a part. It's a part of life too.
Yeah, you can feel loss in a couple of different ways. You can feel the loss of a relationship that you created. You can also feel the loss in a way that in the relationship that you never created. And that's a loss you can't even get a handle on. So you probably have chosen the better of it. You met your husband at App State. Tell us about that. There's a story behind that.
Right. I did meet my husband at Appalachian. We both needed a ride home, and we met in a car ride on the way home. He's the creative member of the family. He's so artistic. He really, as I think about teaching and with the students, you know, his creative spice will come in to help me, you know, think of different ways to incorporate different art and sound.
Well, you are don't dismiss the amount of creative energy that you bring to your work. You talked about sort of ways in which we can help people with dementia, enjoy their food more. You also became involved in a wide range of ethnic communities in Chicago and recognized the need to become more flexible and creative there, too. Tell us about that.
Yes. So growing up in North Carolina, I would say that I was not exposed to great ethnic food growing up. And so, and Boone, although fantastic, also I didn't experience tons of ethnic food. But when I went to Chicago, To make money on the side in graduate school, I would help plan meals and help the congregate meal program. And in Chicago, it's such a densely populated place, the congregate meals would be in the little ethnic cities. And so, you know, we'd be in Little Italy and Chinatown and Germantown. And so I would, you know, go and eat with those older adults. And boy, many times I didn't even know what the foods were, but it was so nice to be with the elders of that community and have them explain to me the foods and how they made them and then allow me to learn. And then I really got to see how different cultures treat their elders and think about their elders. And that was I really learned a lot in those experiences and feel so privileged to participate in those.
What was the most important revelation at that time?
Well, at the time, I don't particularly love really, really, really spicy food. So one of the sort of funny things was that, gosh, these 98-year-olds are eating really hot food. But you know that food is central, regardless of what age you are. Eating and togetherness is central to community and to taking care of each other. And that it didn't matter if we were in Boone, North Carolina, Raleigh, North Carolina, or we were in Chinatown. Those same things were important to everyone.
Talking today to elder adult nutrition expert Amanda Holliday on the state of things. But various communities do have different needs that we don't always think about. You got involved with a community of LGBT adults who are advocating for their health needs. What did you learn there?
Yeah, when I was in Chicago, as I mentioned, I was working with Dr. Goldstein, a geriatrician there, and we were admitting folks to the senior facility where we were, and we had admitted a couple, heterosexual couple, and they went and got a room. They were admitted to a room, and they got to share that room. And then we had a homosexual couple, and they were not allowed to be in that room together. And I remember thinking, what? Say that again? And at that point, I saw firsthand a partner of someone who was in their early stages of dementia and really trying to grapple with this, not be able to be with that person. And it really sparked my passion to make sure that this doesn't happen anymore. And that togetherness is togetherness at any age. And so, yes, we started working on and making sure to change the policies that that would no longer be the case.
And some of those did change, did they?
They did change, yeah. Before I left Chicago, I was proud to be a part of the policy change that was no longer the case and that couples could be together.
Yeah, because again, if you think about all of the dimensions of togetherness, but when it comes to nutrition and being able to eat with a partner you've lived with, it's vital. You ended up moving back to North Carolina, worked at Pitt County Memorial Hospital, and changed the food environment there as well. What'd you find when you got there?
Well, the people of Eastern North Carolina, I mean, as I already said, my grandma's from Eastern North Carolina, and it was so good to be back home and be close to her. Eastern North Carolina, when I got to the hospital, I had come from Chicago where the cafeteria was pretty healthy, and what we were serving upstairs was pretty healthy. And then when I came to Greenville, it was not quite the same, and a lot of fried food. And so we had a task force led by Dr. Kathy Colasa to begin work on trying to increase the healthy foods in the cafeteria. It shouldn't be that we serve one thing upstairs and one thing downstairs, that we all should have access and eat healthy food. And so, yeah, we tried to get the fryers out. We're met with some resistance, but we certainly made it a lot healthier.
Well, some of this you had learned earlier. I mean, the idea, just ways of because I think there was a default in a lot of these institutions, both when you're in Chicago and then you get to Pitt County, of sort of feeding folks Ensure to give them their calories. But you realize that there are ways of maybe putting other food products, bananas, meat, and other things into the food that meant we didn't have to use as much Ensure. I mean, tell us about that.
Yeah, so that's really one of my biggest passions is being creative so that we don't have to go to oral supplements like Boost and Ensure. There's certainly a great place for those when needed, but I hate to see them used as the only choice. And so in Chicago, I was practicing older adult nutrition, but also began working down in the main kitchen for the hospital. And we were almost a 1,000-bed hospital. And we were serving pureed food, like I had talked about earlier. And I was just against it completely. And I began to watch how it was being made. And for example, if we had ground beef patties on the menu, the cooks would take the ground beef and put it in a blender and blend it up and add water.
Ooh.
Until it got to the right consistency and then pour it on the plate. And I asked to try it. And I said, "Do you ever try this?" It, no, of course not. And it was this watery slop. And when you puree meat, it turns this sort of red-brown color. Mm. It's very disgusting. And I thought, well, we shouldn't be serving this. And adding water makes the calories, I mean, it's not as nutrient dense, right? And so so I began trying out different methods. So I started adding bananas to meat. And it's actually quite good if you puree bananas and meat together. It doesn't sound great. And started thinking about how can we make foods more nutrient dense for those people who are having trouble swallowing. And then I started to expand to say, well, if I'm an older adult and maybe I'm deconditioned or it takes me a long time to eat, every bite needs to matter. Every bite needs to have as much nutrition as it can. And how can we go about doing that?
I tell you what, we'll take a break right here and we'll come back and answer that question when my conversation with Amanda Holliday continues on The State of Things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest this hour, Amanda Holliday. Spent most of her career working to better older adult nutrition care. She consults with long-term care facilities, works at UNC Chapel Hill as the program director for the master's program in public health nutrition. So we were talking about ways to make the, you know, sort of institutional food more appetizing. And you, one way you said was actually add bananas to ground beef. Never would have thought of that.
Right. Well, and particularly for those people who are having swallowing trouble, I don't think you and I would want to necessarily do that if we didn't have to. Well, you know, getting back to that idea of when you puree something or you chop something or you cook something very long, you know, it changes how it tastes. And so always circling back to after you prepared it on how can I make this better? So I started thinking about how can I make every bite count? And how does it look on the plate? You know, we began molding. We started thinking about this from Christmas cookie cutters. And could we mold this pureed food in a way that would make it look like the food that it should? So could we take peas, and we actually used icing bags to squirt peas. And when you puree peas, they're not the greatest. So why not add cream to them, a little bit of seasoning herbs in them, and they really just take off on their flavor. And so we started, like in that icing bag, squirting out peas to look like peas on a plate. Of course, when you move your fork across it, it's still...
You get another trick in you.
Yeah. But it looks really good. And now, thankfully, we have molds for almost every food, and they're relatively inexpensive, so you can mold most anything. But then also thinking about nutrient density. How can we incorporate vegetables into this? And can we put vegetables together? And when we puree them, they take off in flavor. You know, blueberries to spinach. We do that in smoothies. But why couldn't we do that? Chutneys with meat. Pineapple. I mean, some of these things that we do naturally. But when we puree them, we could think about them and it would really heighten the flavor and the nutrition.
And it doesn't sound like most of that would cost you any more time.
Not a ton of time, no.
So after you worked at Pitt County Memorial, you moved back to UNC. Tell us about your job now.
Well, I have one of the best jobs in the world, honestly. I love my job. I get to learn from 80 master's students almost every day. I direct the Registered Dietitian Program at UNC Chapel Hill, and we are a 28-month program where students come in with undergraduate degrees and all sorts of things, meet prerequisite courses, and then enroll in our program. And we're year-round, and then 28 months later, they take sit for their credentialing exam to become registered dietitians. So I am fortunate enough to be in the classroom with them from day one. And then I get to go out and be with them while they're at the bedside taking care of patients. And so I'm with them all the way through, and then I see them get jobs and help other people. I mean, what could be more satisfying?
With them, even within their summer residencies, right? Your students do residencies.
Correct.
Now, you could take a break from that. You have to be with them in class, I understand, but the residencies you don't, and yet you have visited every one of them. Is that right?
That's right. I've been doing this 8 years now, and I have visited every single one of them. And we are fortunate enough to have students complete their summer practicums in counties all over the state of North Carolina. So most summers I log somewhere around 5,000 to 6,000 miles in about less than 9 weeks, driving from hospital to hospital, long-term care center to long-term care center, visiting students.
You don't have to do that.
But I love doing it.
Well, what do you see? I mean, so what do you learn from them? Because I'm sure that they it's very valuable to have you there. But what have you learned in all of that? Because it sounds like you've picked up quite a bit just in your experience before all of this. Are you still learning? Are you still picking up new?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I learn from families. You know, families get creative, and they teach us just as much as we teach them. And the students bring their experiences. It's magnificent to have a student who's come from an art background or a background in finance to bring those skills from other areas into the world of nutrition and then transfer them through teaching and caring for their patients to their patients and their families. So I see students do creative things all the time.
What's some of your big surprises, things they've done that you never would have thought of?
Well, this past summer, I had a student in Smithfield, and we were talking about sort of how much we have trouble with everyone wanting to go to Ensure or Boost or these oral supplements. And I'd said, well, you know, she was just so unhappy with that. And she goes, I'm going to figure out the equivalent. I'm going to spend the summer figuring out what the equivalent is, down to the very last vitamin. And so she spent her summer, in addition to her patient care time, on her own time, figuring this out. The same quantity, but she was going to use real food to do it, and she was going to cut the price, and she did it.
Wow.
And then when I went to visit her the second time, we taste tested it with the patients and the dietitians and the physicians and the nurses, and it was fabulous. And I thought, this is just great work. You know, it ended up costing 97 cents. So
wow.
It was just great. And so that was most impressive.
I'm going to re-add your qualifier because you made it during the last segment when we talked about food supplements like Ensure and Boost. And you said at the time, they have their place. They're
right.
Valuable. They can be useful. But you feel that we're using them too often, and creative substitutes like this could be used if we just use a little of imagination so we don't have to use it as much.
Right. Exactly. I don't want to see us go to those first. I want us to keep real food in the mouths of everyone, and we need to be creative to do that.
You just finished a massive reaccreditation project, which has probably absorbed a lot of your time. But I guess your students were involved in that as well, right?
They were. You're right. Like many academic programs, we go through reaccreditation, and we were due for our 10 years. And we had our accrediting body come, and of course, we want to incorporate our alumni, and we listen to our alumni. We do open surveys every year, and so I invited them to come and give their 2 cents during the accreditation. And I think one of the most special moments that will stick with me for the rest of my life was when I opened up the conference call for our alumni to speak with the accrediting body, and to hear over 90 voices say, "Hi, I'm here, Amanda. It's me. I'm in San Francisco. Hey, I'm here. I'm in Wisconsin. This is me. I'm in Puerto Rico. It's me. I'm in the UK. I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. I'm going to support you. This program is awesome." I mean, I sat there and just cried because all those special people that have meant so much to me came and participated.
Obviously, you've had an effect. That's a lot of students to show up, a lot of alums to show up to support the accreditation project. They can just move on. They didn't. They came back, and it's important to them. Is the program, do you specialize in this program in senior adult care, or is it nutrition across the board?
It's broad. We train our students, of course, to be competent from feeding that preterm infant before that baby can suck very well, all the way to end of life. And to be able to feed people in schools, in homes, with families, with chronic disease, acute illness, and everything in between. And so students have the opportunity to specialize in whatever interests them. Certainly, I am over the moon when students want to specialize in older adult nutrition, and many students do that. But of course, with a class that big, we have students that have lots of interests.
Do you make sure that all of them, though, have a kind of a raised consciousness about older adult nutrition?
Absolutely. I'm sure if you ask them, they would tell you that. And I also try to incorporate art and images into the classroom that are positive images about aging. And I, a couple of years ago, got frustrated because I found that our students weren't being empathetic enough to dementia. And so I took them on a virtual dementia tour. And so I actually put them in a suit and I put them in an apartment, like a home apartment that's on campus that actually the occupational therapy students use. And they complete tasks that would be done around the home. Laundry, for example, setting the table, pouring themselves something to drink. And I have them wear the dementia suit. And then afterwards, they write a reflection paper on how this will change their practice.
What is the dementia suit?
Well, let's see. We put little pegs in their shoes, so it throws off their balance, and it also simulates neuropathy, so it's a little bit painful. We put work gloves on their hands, and I tape their fingers together to simulate arthritis. We have goggles that simulate poor peripheral vision and cataracts and macular degeneration, and then we have earphones that we put in their ears that sound like an AM station that can't get tuned in. And then it has loud noises and soft noises. And it really breaks their concentration. And they'll tell you, get this out of my ears. I can't think. And I've had students wander. And when you watch them, they look as if they have dementia. And I'll show them images of people with dementia. And then I'll show them a picture of themselves. And they can't believe in just a few short minutes they look the same. And when they go to find things in the cupboard, they look like someone with dementia. And they say, now I understand why they don't choose the glass. The glass they can't see. They can't see where the water stops. This is why we need to use opaque or clouded glass when we serve someone.
Great stuff. By the way, there is a virtual dementia tour. There's a video of this. And you can get a link to that at our website, stateofthings.org, if you want to see the tour yourself, the video. And you talked about, of course, elder adult nutrition, being more conscious, dementia, another level, and then end of life, which is yet another level of this kind of care and feeding. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, nutrition you need to be fed at the very beginning and at the very end. And it is hard. There's no one right answer. Families, want to feed people to the very end. And I just encourage people to think back on what that person would want and how to incorporate that. And how to do that creatively.
And are there some suggestions? Again, I guess we're always wanting to feed and nurture. I mean, it's the essential, eat. And this is somebody at the end of their life. So what do we do about that when we're so concerned and our concern is heightened? I mean, we really are, we're working even harder to save that person. What do we do?
I think about what's pleasurable. I always remember a client I had when I used to work in home care who traveled the world and got a bottle of wine every place she went. And I remember I had been consulted to work with her at the very end. She'd been given less than 2 weeks to live, and her family was just sort of at the end of their rope on why she wouldn't eat. And so, I just asked her, what do you want? And she said, I want to drink those bottles of wine. I have good memories. I know the people that I went to those places with. And I said, well, let's drink them. And so she actually had a feeding tube, and so she couldn't swallow. She had head and neck cancer. And so but many of my patients had told me that when they have feeding tubes, they burp up the flavors of what they had in their stomach through the feeding tube. So we proceeded to just put a tiny amount of every bottle through her feeding tube, and she would burp up and say, oh, I can taste that. After the very last bottle, of course, she's only drinking, half an ounce of each one. But we talked about each one, and her family was there, and we got to think about all the travels and who went with her. She died the day after we finished the last bottle. So it was pleasure. It was about those memories. So I would think about what's pleasurable. And sometimes not feeding is also pleasurable. We go into a euphoria at the very end when we don't eat. And so remember that too. Whatever is pleasurable for that person.
Talking with nutritionist Amanda Holliday today on the state of things. Amanda, you have a daughter now. Have you tried to share this passion with her? I can't imagine you can stop.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I want Hannah to know that you can have friends of all ages, that you don't have to have friends that are your same age. And I drive a bus for my church and pick up older adults at a continuing care retirement center. And, you know, it's so much joy for me and my family because we are meeting people that we never would have met otherwise. And we are developing relationships. And she now has friends that are 98. And she travels with me to nursing homes. And when my own grandmother had her stroke and was in a nursing home, it never ceased to amaze me how they always connected. Even when maybe grandma couldn't call her name, they would connect. Hannah would sit on her lap. They would hold hands, you know, and they were both at peace. So, yes, Hannah doesn't have much choice. Hannah goes with me, and hopefully those memories will stay with her for a very long time.
All of that is helped, I suspect, by the fact that you and your husband try to make the table a kind of a sacred space. Tell us about dining at your household.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, the family meal is so important, and I definitely want the family table to be a place where we can ask, you know, Hannah can ask any question. Just yesterday, we had come home from church, and she asked me about someone in our congregation that was having tremors, and she said, "Mommy, why does she do that?" And I said, "Well, she has Parkinson's disease," and so we talked about that. You know, that's a time when people maybe can't, you know, they can't control their muscles. And Hannah said, "Well, I just want to love her, and you know, I want her to see that that's, you know, the person is still there, and that's who we need to connect with, and that's our friend."
The idea that this is the space where she can ask any question, it sounds a little bit like, you know, anybody who's got a boss with an open door policy, you know what that means. So, but really, kids do pick up on the fact that there are things we're not going to talk about. They pick up on it instantly, and if you're busy running around, they know they got a question. We're not talking about this in this family. If you actually create a space and a rule that says, here, any question you want, it does kind of change things.
Huh? It does, yeah. And it's really the centering time of the day. It's the time when she can be relaxed and calm to ask whatever she wants and talk about whatever she wants. And for us to let her know that we're interested in what happened to her today, too.
Amanda, thank you so much.
What
a pleasure talking with you. Amanda Holliday is Program Director for the UNC Chapel Hill Master's Program in Public Health Nutrition. As I say, you can see a link to the virtual dementia tour, the video, on our website, stateofthings.org, and find out lots more information at that same website. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley is our intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. And North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.